Welcome to the NASCAR on NBC podcast. I'm your host, Nate Ryan. We have two return guests on our 14th episode, and these were some of my favorite interviews in NASCAR even before they became my coworkers. I've always said that the best interviews are those in which I end the conversation smarter than how I started it, and I began covering auto racing without knowing anything about it. So anytime I could pick up morsels of information that would help explain the nuances of what can be a very complicated sport at times, I've always been appreciative. And I'm still learning about racing nearly 20 years later, and that's been in part due to talking to people such as Steve Letarte and Parker Kligerman, who have helped me understand those nuances and gain more insight and more knowledge into what makes NASCAR tick. Steve and Parker, of course, both are NBC Sports analysts. They make regular appearances on NASCAR America, and while they are fantastically well-spoken and entertaining on camera, I think what really sets these guys apart is their insight. Both of these guys are really, really smart, and I think sometimes that gets lost sight of in racing, which isn't known so much for being a scholarly endeavor, perhaps nearly as much as it should be. Steve and I were talking after a recent NASCAR America show, and I learned that he scored much higher than I did on the SATs, which should have come as no great surprise. Steve didn't go to college, but he has an enormous aptitude for learning, and he built a vast knowledge base since he joined Hendrick Motorsports as a teenager. He knows a lot about NASCAR, and whenever I've asked him questions, even going back to his days as a crew chief 10 years ago, there always has been a brilliance to his answers. And the same holds true for Parker. And he, of course, also puts that cerebral approach to work behind the wheel. And this weekend, he's going to return to racing in a truck at Kansas Speedway. So we'll talk to Parker in the second half of the episode a little bit about his outlook for the underfunded team that he's with right now, which basically is taking it a race at a time, despite being second in points. Parker's team lost a key employee recently, which meant a 33% reduction in staff. Yes, his team has all of three full-time employees, but they're still soldiering on, and they're thinking about trying to make the chase as it makes its debut in the Truck Series this year. So we'll also get Parker's thoughts on the racing at Talladega, how the lower downforce package will impact this weekend at Kansas Speedway, and how he manages those driver simulator segments that you see on NASCAR America, particularly when he is doing them live. To me, talking on national TV while driving, it seems like that would be quite difficult, but Parker makes it look easy, and he's got some funny stories about that. In the first half of the episode, we'll ask Steve what he thought about the racing at Talladega, particularly the airborne crashes. Steve has some real interesting thoughts about how the aero development of these cars on the underside in particular might be playing a role. All of the development going on now, or a lot of it for teams, is really happening on the underbodies. And Steve has some good explanations about how that might have contributed to three cars getting airborne in separate incidents Sunday at Talladega. We'll also get Steve's thoughts on the recent rash of steering wheel problems. Dale Earnhardt Jr.'s plate struggles, of course. Steve was Dale Jr.'s crew chief for many years at Hendrick, and he has some good insight into what's going on there in terms of his struggles at Daytona and Talladega this season. And Steve also will talk about the recent brilliance of Brad Keselowski at Talladega. As always, we appreciate you listening. Please leave a rating or review on iTunes, or send me feedback on Twitter about the show, guest list, topics, format. We're all ears. So without further ado, here are our conversations with Steve and Parker. All right, joined now in our NBC podcast studios, NASCAR and NBC podcast studios, by Steve Letarte, who has the microphone in his hand, rock star style, in a way I don't think we've done this before.
I feel a little Elvis Presley like, or you know, that kind of old school mic is what you have. So I'm going to hold it over here like I'm really getting on with it.
I'll take a photo of this so everybody can fully appreciate it later on Twitter. Obviously, we brought Steve in because we want to talk about Talladega Super Speedway. A lot of news coming out of there. Steve, let's start with the most obvious story, which, of course, was the crashes. I know this is nothing new from your perspective, but three airborne crashes, I think, reached a tipping point with Buescher, with Kenseth, with Harvick at the finish, that, and with Steve O'Donnell coming out and saying today, this is something we're going to look at. We're already looking at it immediately. We're talking to teams. What's your takeaway as somebody who spent a lot of time in that garage, went to Talladega many times, has seen these kinds of wrecks before? Anything that can be done, anything that should be done? What's your view?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, it's important to explain to the fan that racing is inherently dangerous and there's going to be accidents. And that doesn't sugarcoat it. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't, as a sport, whether it's an analyst or a crew chief or an owner or whomever could do it, move forward with safety. It should be the number one priority. And I think that's why people get frustrated with Talladega, because the accidents become very large. They're normally not of the people in the accidents doing. You know, when you go to Charlotte and you crash, usually it's a two-car crash and one of you, if not both of you, are at fault. So you kind of don't really worry about it. Where at Talladega, if you have a crash, there could be 8, 10, 12 cars in it. That, I think, raises the frustration level. And it's always going to be dangerous, as I mentioned. But the concern really is the airborne cars. You know, safe walls, safer cars. Nothing is a guarantee, but NASCAR has done a great job of increasing the opportunity for a driver to walk away from some serious crashes. But when cars get airborne, it's very hard to control their energy, very hard to understand where they go. And there's always going to be that opportunity. Like the Austin Dillon crash at Daytona, I look as a very odd opportunity. The car gets airborne, hit by another car, put up into the catch fence. You know, there's no way you can simulate that. That rarity is always going to happen. But when I watch Talladega, my concern is that Matt Kenseth was a relatively straightforward rollover.
Right.
And NASCAR should be commended between the roof flaps and the hood flaps and the side windows and the side skirts and quarter pedal length. They've done a lot of things to keep these cars on the ground. All I'm saying is the aerodynamic package at Talladega hasn't changed in a while, yet we start to see more and more cars get airborne. So I question as if, you know, if NASCAR takes away downforce, yet teams can find 25% of it back with underbody stuff, mm-hmm. what is the underbody effects of their speedway cars? I mean, these teams obviously don't worry about flipping them over. They worry about going as fast as possible. So perhaps NASCAR needs to take a more up-to-date car, maybe even confiscate a couple cars and do some you could do some aerodynamic testing, sideways testing in the wind tunnel, turn them to high degrees of yaw, just something, because they are getting off the ground a little easier, in my opinion, than they had in the past.
In the waning days of the wing, that seemed to be the criticism, was that it was causing almost a helicopter effect when they were going into a spin, and we saw liftoff, whether it was Keselowski at Atlanta or,
right.
or Edwards at Talladega. Obviously, they addressed that, put the spoiler on, but as you said, maybe all the...
The simple thing is these cars are the only one, and this is an awful thing to say, but it's true. The only one who cares about the liftoff speed of those cars is NASCAR.
NASCAR, yeah.
Because I was a crew chief for 20 years, and never did I change tailpipes and say, man, that's 3 counts of drag better. Man, I wonder if that thing will fly. But never. That's not my job. My job was to make the fastest car possible. And I want that to be known. I want the fans to understand the challenge that NASCAR has, because these crew chiefs worry about building fast race cars, as they should. So that means the onus of safety to keep these cars on the ground truly lands all on NASCAR.
Yeah.
And they're going to need some help because, it's pretty simple. We saw a couple of cars get upside down. If you take a still shot of those cars upside down, they don't all look the same from the underneath, which
right.
tells me that teams are doing things to help the performance. And perhaps inadvertently, the downstream effect is something that changes the rollover speed. I call it the rollover speed, which is basically when you take a car sideways, a little past sideways, there's a speed in which a car will lift, and that's physics. And the wind, the roof flaps, all of those things were to reduce that speed. The idea is to increase the speed. So it takes a faster car to get off the ground. They want to get that number as high
right.
as possible, which means it's really hard to get one in the air.
Did it look like the 20s flaps deployed okay? Did it look correct?
They looked okay. I'd have to watch it again. Buescher's didn't look like they deployed because they didn't have time. It was a real quick snap roll. We've seen that before. The 20s, you know, I think some smarter people than me are going to look at it. It was very odd. He got hit at an awkward angle, but those are going to happen. And other than contact from the 10, that was really the only contact you saw, and the car took off.
Right.
So that would be the one that I think NASCAR can learn the most from.
And just to clarify, when you're talking about teams working on that underside, that's where the majority of the development on cars is happening now? Because that's like the uncharted territory.
Well, it has to be, right? The bodies are, we hear about all the time, there's the grid with all these templates and they're Romer armed and the gold surface and white light scan, and we hear cars go to the tech center and they always pass. Basically, the room for improvement is the areas on the car you don't see, and that's where they're working.
Right. Another big issue that's emerged on the technical side seems to be this steering wheel thing. Obviously, we saw it during the race with Dale Jr. having his wheel come off after the hit with Carl Edwards. Apparently, we saw prior to this race that Nick Sandler, crew chief for Ricky Stenhouse Jr., gets suspended for a race because the mechanism, the coupler, was improper, wasn't SFI certified. We saw at Phoenix in qualifying that Jimmy Johnson had his wheel come off. What do you make of that? This rash of sudden steering wheel things, and what's going on there?
Well, the Dale Jr. one, I think, has been addressed by him on Twitter. He said that basically it was his own mistake. We've actually found the footage. We're going to show it on NASCAR America. That he basically just didn't put the wheel on. He put it on halfway and put the rest of his belts on and drove out of the garage, and lo and behold, it came off. But it seems to be a rash of them. So I think NASCAR, they obviously are looking at it because they found something in I'll say unapproved or maybe not SFI approved with the 17 cars quick release coupler. So it's obviously something that they are inspecting, which makes me think that if they caught the 17s, they probably looked at everyone's. Mm-hmm. So I would say that everyone in the garage must have complied except for the 17. Therefore, there was a penalty. And in the end, the teams have responsibility to build safe parts, and NASCAR can inspect it. And I was proud of Dale for stepping up and saying, hey, look, I messed up. I don't know what happened in the Jimmy Johnson situation. I think if I go back, there was some Twitter conversation there where he said, look, I just didn't get it on right.
I think he pretty much said the same thing. He owned up to it too.
And while that doesn't make it right, it doesn't make we can't make it better. Mm-hmm. I don't want to ever think that we can't improve things. The simple fact is, this is a great reminder for 8-year-old kids and 15-year-old kids and 20-year-old guys who are having late models that certain responsibility falls on the driver and putting his own belts on. My son runs dirt outlaw carts, and I check his belts because he's 12, but the first thing he learned to do was to put his own steering wheel on and put his belts on. And I say I check his belts, but when we go practice and he goes in and out 100 times, I'm sure there are times he puts them on himself or puts his own steering wheel on and goes out and runs. As a driver, he has that responsibility, and I think that's why you saw Dale Jr. and Jimmy Johnson both not pointing the finger anywhere except at themselves. They know it lands on their responsibility, but it is very dangerous when one of those things come off. Because not only do you lose control of the vehicle, but then you have this steering shaft basically uncovered right in front of the driver.
Yeah, not good, obviously, but if a teachable moment, as they say, can emerge from it, and young racers can look and see, hey, that's Jimmy Johnson does this, Dale Jr. does this, I'm not going to do this because they're telling me, here's what I did wrong. That is some positive that could emerge from it. Speaking of Dale Jr., he was pretty candid. I don't think he put all of the brunt on his team, but this was Talladega was the second restrictor plate race this year in which he had what appeared to be a fast car and just spun out. Happened at Daytona, and he said it right after he spun out in that first crash at Talladega. He said snapped around just like Daytona, and then he talked about, we got to figure something out with the handling, because obviously there's some trade-off there where too much to the speed side and not enough on the secure side. What do you make, as someone who obviously has prepared restrictor plate cars for Dale Jr. in the past, what do you think he's looking for? And is the team just pushing the envelope too much to try to keep up with the Gibbs cars and there's too much of a trade-off there? What do you make of what's going on there?
Well, I think you have to go all the way back to last year, and you have the 88 car, probably the most dominant speedway car in all four races. Even though he didn't win the Daytona 500, he had probably the car to beat. Made a very simple mistake off turn two, got taken three wide, ended his chance for the 500. Won the next two speedway races and arguably had the third one, other than a caution, he had that one won.
Right.
So what that does is that gives a team and a crew chief a great foundation to lean on, a great foundation to start with. You would assume, and I'm assuming, I haven't talked to Greg about this, that they went back to Daytona this year with that same foundation because the speed showed, once again, they were one of the favorites. But I think at Daytona, we heard handling caught a lot of guys off guard with the temperatures and things like that. And I think perhaps we dismissed the 88 spin by himself as the same thing we saw with the 24. There were other cars down there. It wasn't just Dale Jr. But when I go to Talladega, he was the lone car, in my mind, that had a singular wreck. Now, he collected the five, but he spun on his own. So I think at this point, they have to be concerned because I've had Dale Jr. as a driver. He's very adamant about the speed he needs in his restrictor plate cars. And they obviously know how to get it because they're one of the favorites every day when they practice. But they have to find a way to get these cars to the finish. And there's a balance there. And I don't think he was mismatched on tires. I just think his car has something about it. When he gets in a situation, it it becomes very undrivable. Both situations were really kind of the same, a car to the left, a car to the right. He was kind of stuck in the middle, unloaded off turn two at Talladega, unloaded on the front stretch at Daytona. So I think there's some aerodynamic stuff or perhaps some geometry in the front end, something to keep that car a little more secure. But they're going to have to address it. I think they can't. You know, when you look back, hindsight's 20/20, but obviously they had the same issue twice. Yeah. So what happened at Daytona perhaps wasn't just a Daytona thing. And when you go to 4th of July, Daytona, Hannah is going to really be an issue.
Right.
So I think they're going to have to really approach it, whether that's an aerodynamic thing or a chassis setup thing. But, you know, Dale's not pointing the finger because he practices the car as well. I mean, he has a responsibility of a driver to say, hey, man, this has a lot of those same characteristics. So it's one of those things. I think more than anything, there's just so much put on Dale Jr. at the speedways. The buzz is around him. Everybody talks about him. So it's really negative when he spins, especially twice by himself.
Right. Well, obviously, when we head to Daytona, he will be a favorite again, just like he was in February. He was strong then. Another name, though, who clearly is emerging and perhaps isn't getting credit for it as a favorite on the restrictor plate tracks, Brad Keselowski wins his fourth plate race. They're all at Dega. That's not to say he doesn't perform well at Daytona as well, but I mean, there's something about this kid, obviously, at this track. No one, since he won his first race in 2009, no one has won more plate races in Cup than Brad Keselowski. And I don't know if his name ever rises to the top when we talk about great drafters, great plate racers. You worked with him a little bit, I know, when he was at Hendrick. You've obviously watched him as a competitor on the track. What do you see there? What about him? I mean, does he have that ability that Dale Jr. has to see that air that in a way other guys don't?
Well, I think first thing, Daytona and Talladega are very, very different. The only real similarity is that they both run a restrictor plate. Other than that, they're not similar at all. One's very narrow, one's very wide. Brad strikes me as having much more success at Talladega. The stats not only prove it, but just in general, he's run well at Daytona, but not like he has at Talladega. And I really believe, first of all, his talent is not in question. Really, no one in the Cup Series, in the top 20, 30 in the Cup Series, I mean, they're there because they're very talented. It's Brad is a unique competitor. He probably has more self-confidence than anyone else out there. And the reason I say that is because he doesn't look for acceptance from his competitors. He doesn't care if Carl Edwards likes him. He doesn't care if Tony Stewart thinks what he's doing is right or wrong. He doesn't care. Like, you'll see the two car go out and practice at New Hampshire and ride around slow for three laps when no one else is doing it, and you wonder why they're doing this. He has a lot of confidence in his own program, in his own ability, in his own car to beat to his own drum. And I think when you take that to Talladega, that's actually a feather in his cap. I think he doesn't worry about Joey Logano. I think Joey Logano doesn't worry about Brad Keselowski. I think they worry about their own cars. And in the end, Brad does a very good job understanding the ebb and flow of a 500-mile race at Talladega. And it's more track position than everybody wants to give it credit to. They say track position doesn't matter. I would argue the difference. Tell me the last time somebody didn't win off the front row at Talladega on the last restart. Brad knows that, and he puts himself there time and time and time again. I don't think it's any coincidence that he came up through the ranks of junior motorsports. I think he's a student of the game. I would bet Brad Keselowski watches a lot of these races. You know, he does a lot of the right things to practice. He doesn't take it for granted, I think. He puts the effort in, and it's showing. It's also, you know, I'll be the guy that tell you, stats will tell you one out of three pigs will build the house out of bricks. So, you know, speedway racing right. is very cyclical. Some guys have it, some guys don't. But right. He's now won in the tandem form in the James Finch 09. He's then won in the standard drafting form as we know it now.
Yep.
And when he won the chase race to move through, you know, that was a must-win situation. And it reminded me of Dale Jr.'s performance last fall. You know, to go to Talladega, and we talk about the randomness of Talladega. It strikes me odd that 2 years in a row, two cars with a must-win situation were both leading on the last lap.
Right.
Tells me that maybe it isn't as random as we all want to make it be.
That's what I think, too. There might be something to the fact that as much as we talk about, oh, it's a roulette wheel, anybody can win, true, but it does seem like the same guys, Dale Jr.
Brian
and Brad Keselowski.
Brian Vickers said it the best. It's not that you don't have your favorites when you go to Talladega and you don't have your cars you would bet on. The problem is there aren't any cars you could bet against.
Right.
Where when we go to Kansas this weekend, there are 15 cars that if you want to go ahead and give me your money, they can't win.
Right.
Talladega, there's nearly no one you can take out of the box, but there are still your favorites, and Brad Keselowski has got to be rising to the list of everyone on their favorites.
Right. Appreciate it, man. Thanks for joining us. We'll
hey, I like it. I like. I mean, you didn't let me in the real studio. We're kind of here in the office studio, which is kind of a little bit of a downgrade.
We have windows in here, though.
We do have windows. I can look at the traffic. I do like the old school mics. I get to hold it kind of like I'm an old school rapper. So that always makes me feel pretty confident. But it'll be interesting. It's shaping up to be a great race for the chase here. The 26 weeks is going to. We're already starting to see some irritated drivers, and I don't think we're going to be done seeing irritated drivers as we move into the summer.
You think Kenseth Logano flares up again by the time NBC takes over the schedule in July?
You know, I think it's Kenseth Logano and anyone else because it's funny. We only have a handful of winners, and now the same handful have won a second time.
Yeah.
So, you know, who hasn't won? Who's going to be the next first-time winner?
Definitely going to be a lot to watch over the rest of the regular season. Keep watching NASCAR America to listen to this guy. And again, thanks for being here, man. Appreciate it. All right, joined now by Parker Kligerman, who thankfully has found a sweatshirt so that he can be warm enough, comfortable enough to do this interview on the NASCAR and NBC podcast. Thanks for joining us, Parker. You have paid your heating bill, correct? We're good on that front? Okay, all right.
Well, I appreciate you having me on and pointing out how cold I am, but I just explained it's a little bit the situation where it hasn't quite warmed up enough today for some odd reason. It's also raining, and I thought it was supposed to stop raining in May. But, so you get, like, the days get to, like, 65, they go higher, and then at night it drops, like, 40 degrees outside. So you don't put the heat on, but then when you're walking around the house in the morning, it's freezing. So I need to find a sweatshirt. We'll be warm enough for this interview.
Where is home? Home is Stanford, I take it?
Stanford, Connecticut, yeah.
Okay.
Right near our NBC studios. I can actually see it from my apartment right now.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm looking at the building.
Fantastic. Do you walk to work then?
No, I just can see. We're on the 19th floor, so when I look across, we're pretty high up, and so I can see the building that it's in from here. So, but that's still like a 8-minute drive, 10-minute drive.
Nice. All right, well, you've been making that drive quite a bit lately. We've seen you on NASCAR America doing your great analysis as always, but we also got some news this week. Truck Series back at Kansas Speedway, and so are you. I know that your future somewhat has been a little bit cloudy because of the sponsorship situation. I presume that you're running this weekend. That means things are maybe looking up a little bit. Tell us about how Kansas came together and the outlook for the team going forward.
Yeah, so we basically decided we're going to do Kansas, then Dover, then Charlotte, and we've got a brand new truck we're building that hopefully will be ready for Texas. It's kind of like we're doing it in chunks almost. It's very similar back in ARCA when I went there in 2009. We started out, we had funding for like six races, the six or eight races, I can't remember. And right before the season started, Michael Nelson, who's the GM at Penske Racing, Team Penske, said to him, hey, let's just do the first eight and see where we end up. And sure enough, we did the first eight, and we ended up winning, like, our fourth, fifth race, and then we won, like, two more, and we're just on fire and leading the points, so we were able to make it go all season. But even 15 races in the season, we were still race by race. It was pretty funny. We still won nine races that year.
Wow.
And so this year, I came in, it's always, my whole career has been this way. If you've been in my inner circle of like my managers and my parents and everyone, we always laugh. But my manager especially always had the same. We were like, there's always next year where we would get that one time where we have a full year deal. We knew we were running it and we maybe even had a 2-year deal, which is like, you couldn't even talk about a 2-year deal. I mean, that's just, you know, that was like stuff for the moon. I'm pretty used to this. And so this year, you know, I started off where I got a call to go to Daytona. Then my owner said, hey, why don't we do Atlanta 1 week later? Then we came out there leading the points, and we said, heck, we got to go to Martinsville. And then we came out there with a really good run, and we're really solidly in the top three in points now, way ahead in fourth and fifth. So, you know, we just said, hey, look, you got three more coming up with a month off. We could prepare, and we're feeling pretty prepared and ready to go race these next three and then hopefully race Texas as well. So we'll see. We're just going to keep going, and with the chase format, to be part of the chase, you only got to make it 15 races. It kind of even condenses the amount of funding you need to see if you can fight for a championship. So, we'll see. I'd like to get one of those rings, be like the first like TV guy and driver at the same time to go get a ring. So
I like that. That's a good goal. And it's certainly good that, as you said, you've got, fortunately and unfortunately, you have some history with this. So maybe it's not as unsettling as it might be for another driver. You've been through this situation before. And it's interesting you bring up the chase, because I was going to ask, how much did that play a factor? Because you're still second in points. You guys had a month virtually to regroup there after Martinsville. Did that give you a lot of time to maybe consider the scenarios and run the points and figure out, hey, this might make sense to just keep it going for now?
Well, you know, it helped us with talking to our sponsors, Advanced Auto Parts and Valvoline, who've been big supporters of us this season so far. I know it's crazy to say we've only done three races, but they have been very helpful. And I think some of what, our positivity and ability to go has been because of their support and kind of increasing their support a little bit. So that's cool, to have those companies kind of see what we're doing and get behind it. And they're both, through Ricky Bed, my owner, his company, Black's Tire Service and such, and his stores, that there's a lot of business synergy there and that sort of thing. So I think there's a lot of great correlations, and then having a great on-track performance, and getting a lot of buzz and that sort of thing helps a ton. So that's been good. But I wouldn't say that we discussed, hey, how can we get to Homestead? It's kind of more like, hey, how do we get to the next couple? And then we'll kind of figure out the next couple and we'll see. I mean, we actually had an unfortunate situation where we lost our truck chief. He left the team, Bobby Gill, to go back to a thing a little closer to home, which unfortunately was a cool, very key part of our team, being that we had three people. So we've been down to two for a little while now.
Wow.
my crew chief and Mike Hammond are mechanics. So, yeah, we're as small as it gets, but we got a lot of heart. And, this month off has helped them prepare, and we're going against all the odds. So hopefully we can come out with a victory here soon. I just feel like, the first three, we just consistently, once we get in the race, are able to create speed and really, maybe some of it's using our experience and how much time I have spent in the truck series to kind of manufacture great finishes. And I think we can do that maybe with W.
Well, if you manage to knock off another top 10 at Kansas despite losing 33% of your team, I'd say that's a story that I would hope everybody stumbles across and gives you a lot of pub for that. Where are you guys, just because I'm curious, Parker, are you guys based in the business park in Mooresville, where I know a lot of the truck teams are? Is it a small shop there? How's that work?
No, so that's part of the problem. Well, the great thing is, Ricky Benton and the race team, Ricky Benton's from Sarasota, North Carolina, and the race team's there in Sarasota, North Carolina, and it's kind of a real small town, and you get that small town support for the race team, and Mike Hetzer, my crew chief, is from there, and he lives there, but it's 3 hours from Charlotte. So when you look at the idea of being able to get talent in there, mechanic wise and that sort of thing, it's a tough sell in that sense, especially for a team that's like us, not fully committed to an entire year and that such. So it's a bit of a tough situation to get, someone out there and to convince them to stay and that sort of thing. So I think, Ricky and them, they do a great job that they got up there. They have a great shop. It's a cool little town and cool that they can do it from home and, have everything kind of right there where they live. And I think it's a lot of fun for them, but it definitely adds a little bit of challenge, but we're doing the best we can what we have, and I think Mike Hester and Mike Hammond, they're working hard enough to figure it out. If we can, I think there's some options out there, hopefully, to get someone else again in the team and continue our great run.
I did not realize that the team was that far away from the hub. That's that's a great story in itself too. So
I've done the drive a couple times. So I've done it. I'd fly down there. Like go do a seat fitting or something, and with my schedule and such, I'd literally fly down to Charlotte on a 6 a.m. flight, get a rental car, drive 3 hours down there, hang out with them for 3 hours, 4 hours, back in the rental car, drive 3 hours back and fly home. So So I've done that like 3 or 4 times this season.
Nothing is easy with your team is what you're saying, which is great because when you have this kind of success, it makes it an even better story. That's really amazing. Well, best of luck certainly with that going forward, Parker. It sounds like race to race, day to day, kind of like we are all are in life, and kind of like things were at Talladega on Sunday. I think it was lap to lap for a lot of drivers and teams, like it always is. And clearly, a lot of discussion coming out of that race about what is the level of acceptable risk. And I know you're a thinking man's racer. You put a lot of analysis into this. That's why we have you on the program. What's your assessment of what happened Sunday? And I guess going forward, you know, are there changes needed? Is there a sense of resignation that this is what we have and this is what we're always going to have? And that, again, drivers are just going to need to measure that level of risk every lap. Where do you follow on all of it?
Well, the beginning of the season, I want to bring up a quote that was, I think, laughed at in a lot of circles. But when you think about it, it did make sense. Brian France, when asked what the biggest problem in NASCAR is, he said rain. I don't know if anyone remembers that, but and I think it was kind of laughed at to say, you know, oh, come on, there's so many other problems out there. But then when you look at this last weekend's race, what preceded the, you know, why did they wreck so often? Why was there such aggressive racing, which is what we want to see? We always talk about, look at the Xfinity series where we shorten the races. And so some of the drivers got up and said, you know, when you have a shorter race, you just have to go harder, quicker. Well, throughout, since I've been watching NASCAR, I think some of my favorite races have always been where there's impending rain, right? Where suddenly in the Cup Series, these drivers feel like, you know what? We're racing halfway. And so you're sitting there where you'd normally be not riding, but, you know, protecting your equipment, trying to set yourself up strategically. And suddenly you are put in a position where you're like, I need to go and I need to go now. And it's early in the race. And then everyone else gets the idea, oh, wait, I could win this race because I just need to go now if everyone else isn't going. And you get in a situation like we've seen like a couple years ago at Martinsville. We had a crazy race there when it was even drizzling a little bit. And it was, I think it was 4 or 5 years ago. And it was one of my favorite races I ever watched because the drivers went so hard from the get-go because they knew there was something coming. Not in the races I've been in, I can name a couple where we actually played it to where we were in the lead when we thought it was going to rain, and sure enough, it didn't rain. But that was some of the most intense races I've ever done because not only were you racing the track, yourself, your competition, but you were racing Mother Nature. Mm-hmm. And it just put a whole X factor on the race. And I think that's, you know, what we saw then. I mean, let's be honest, I don't think we saw, you know, Daytona, which was a perfectly sunny day, hot and slick. We did not see the wreck fest 2500 that we saw at Talladega, right?
Right.
And I think one thing to add into why you saw cars flipping over, et cetera, is that you did have these cars in overcast conditions, slightly cooler temperatures, going very fast and driving very aggressively compared to when we've normally seen at Talladega and Daytona in recent years, where it gets hot, it gets slick, it becomes a little bit of a handling race, and the things sort of calm down a little bit. So I hate to say one race is the mark to change everything, because we've been at this package for, what, 4 years now almost? This certain downforce package and restriction plate setup and everything that we have, and it's probably one of the longer-running packages we've had at Super Speedways, because it created this great pack racing that we wanted to see back without having the tandem and, you know, kind of has made the car and the team have to work really hard to make a fast car, unlike when you were in the tandems, and it's rewarding teams that bring a fast car and drivers that know the track. And so, you know, one bad race, I think, where, you know, there was a lot of X factors and circumstances that added up to what you saw to say, you know, there's an issue. I don't think there's an issue.
Right.
But, you know, for a risk, I mean, look, you have two tracks that you basically allow these cars to go perpetually 200 miles an hour. So, I guess perpetually is not the right word, but consistently 200 miles an hour. That's where I've been for. Consistently 200 miles per hour in a lap, right? All within 1 second of each other. Is there going to be issues? Yes, especially at this level where you're fighting for so much, and especially at these two tracks where drivers and teams feel like they have a chance.
Right.
And at this level, if you give someone a chance, if you give them an inch, they're going to try and take a foot, right? If you give them a foot, they're going to try and take a mile. And that's what you see at these super speedways. And that's part of the chess game. And I think, you know, there's no easy solution. I saw Denny Hamlin's solution, which was my opinion has always been, if you don't want pack racing at Daytona and Talladega, you absolutely don't slow them down. If you slow them down, you're going to create some form of weird racing. If you go on iRacing, this is something you can do for other people to do. Go take a car like the Legends car or even one of the road course cars that's going to top out at about 150, 170 miles an hour and go have a race. It will be a pack, but it'll be the worst race you've ever done because it's frustrating. You can't pass. There's no movement. The cars are too overgripped. It's some of the worst things you've ever done. So slowing them down isn't going to work. But the other idea is just remove the restrictor plate and let them go 250 miles an hour and move the grandstands back. To me, then you would end up with like a mile and a half, a unique mile and a half situation, but it'd be a mile and a half going 250 miles an hour. So I say, you know, what we have now is something we've created, and it's something fans have come to know and has become what these tracks are known for. But if I were to make any change, I would try to make the drag a little bit higher on the car so they punched a little bit bigger hole in the air, and it was easier to pass.
Right.
That's my thoughts.
You mentioned that Denny Hamlin interview, Parker, and another thing he said was essentially that drivers have become too good at plate racing, and that it's impossible when everybody is on everybody else's quarter panel, like when you're barely giving an inch in every single corner, because everybody understands now the nuances of side drafting the way they didn't even 10 or 15 years ago. Everybody goes back and watches these tapes. Is there something to that? And I hear what you're saying completely. Like maybe slowing them down maybe isn't a fix, because Denny also said, as you just noted, that you slow them down and everybody gets more comfortable, you're going to have more wrecks. They're just maybe going to be less likely to go airborne. But is it just a matter of, I sit here and I try to wrap my brain around this, and it's like trying to solve a calculus equation. There's just no, you just keep like trying to like reduce it down to its purest form. And there's like just no simple solution that emerges. And I guess what I'm asking is, if the drivers are so good, at doing this now, is it just a matter of we just sort of have to appreciate it from that perspective and find a different way of looking at it? Maybe we don't focus enough. You know, maybe there's so much talk about it just being a roulette wheel and anybody can win these races. Should we focus more on the fact that maybe drivers have applied themselves to becoming so good at plate races the way they became, you know, the bar was raised on road courses over the last several years?
I absolutely agree with that. I think, you know, it's always funny to me, especially Cup, that, you know, we use this like anyone can win mantra. And I've said it, and then I kind of think about it for a while. I'm like, why did I say that? Because especially in this package right now is forcing you to build the absolute fastest race car you can build, put a little bit of handling in it, and then have a driver who fully understands the use of the draft and fully understands the ability to lead these races and what lines to use. And it's incredibly complex. Yes, is there an element of randomness when there's 40 cars all in a little one-second pack that something can just be taken out of your control? Yes. But Brad Keselowski won this race last weekend because he had a car that they worked on after Daytona because they weren't fast enough. I remember talking to that team after the duels, and they ran second or top five. They were at one point, and they fell back. And I said, what's your biggest problem? He said, we just need speed. We don't have enough speed compared to the 88 at the time. And that was during the duels. It was, you know, it was nighttime. It was really cold, and it was a lot of grip. And speed was everything. And back when we had the tandem, and maybe when cars even punched a bigger hole in the air, that wasn't something that came up. Like in the tandem situation, you could take a car that literally qualified 40th out of 40 cars, and it would be leading the race if the right car was pushing it. And that was, you know, we just don't see that now. You're not going to see Front Row Motorsports suddenly put a car in the lead. They might get in the top five, but to take the lead right now is incredibly tough. And I think, you know, that's one thing that we're seeing out of this package. But yes, do drivers right now understand the draft better than maybe before? Well, why was Dylan able to go from 18th to first in two laps, whatever it was?
Right.
Back, you know, in the early 2000s?
16 years ago.
Because,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. 15 years ago, yeah, because he understood, you know, he was a level above him, and he used to say, oh, he can see the air. Well, he saw just what we now know, right? Which
right.
is that there is the side draft. There is points where you're putting the air onto someone's boiler. There's times where you're in a little bit of a low pressure zone. There's times where your cowl pressure is matching their cowl pressure and sucking air from each other through the engine. It's stuff that, you know, has been very scienced out, and we see this throughout racing as a whole in the world, is that stuff gets scienced out as it becomes common knowledge. Everyone loses the advantage, right? And then it becomes kind of this whole everyone gets it thing, right? And it's static. And I think drivers absolutely do know this better, and that's why we're seeing some of the incredible moves. We see some of the incredible, you know, ability of some drivers to control a race, to get to be consistently at the front. And I like that. I think it's more about skill now. I think there's an incredible chess game happening at 200 miles per hour, more so than ever before, because everyone understands it and they know what they need to bring, and they know from studying the tapes and such. But one element that doesn't get talked about that much, and we actually talked about it on NASCAR America last week, though, and that is the element that there's a whole other set to this that's happening, and that's the spotter. And, you know, forever in NASCAR, spotter, you know, in recent years it's become far more important, but forever it was, you know, oh, just a guy in the sky, you can get anyone, they can just tell you where the car is around you. And now, especially at the super speedways, these spotters are having to work race tape and watch and understand exactly the runs that these lines are creating, exactly which line is moving when and if it's going to stall out, and understanding that and being able to plot that so that he can tell the driver, okay, this line's coming, this one isn't, don't worry about it. And that's the difference between winning and losing. That's the difference between running top five and top ten. And the spotter has probably become one of the most integral portions of the race team at a super speedway. More so in the fact that instead of just telling you and guiding you along the racetrack, they are literally giving you the plays behind you as if you're a football player and you could be told the play that's happening in front of you. Then that's happening behind you, actually. That's what they're doing for the drivers.
Right.
And they're plotting these races as much as the driver is. If you listen to Joey Meyer, who's Brad Keselowski's spotter, he will go through incredible detail of each and every line that Brad doesn't even need to look in the mirror. He paints a picture for him. And then at the same time, he'll suggest and sometimes even tell him, go to this line. This line's coming. Don't go to it. You know, you'll hear those. They're saying, hey, five cars on the top left by the 17. Good run. It's going to stall out here by the 18 car. You know, fan, that's what's going to happen because he's researched it. He's watched race tape. He understands the runs. He's looked in practice and understood it as much as the driver. And that's because the spotters are becoming so integral, that sort of thing. Joe Logano, him and his spotter, I think it's Tab Boyd. Is his
correct.
Name?
Yep,
is his
Tab
name?
Boyd. Mm-hmm.
They actually last year, before they won the Daytona 500, watched race tape and tried to get into a cohesive relationship about exactly what's happening on the racetrack. If you are not in that sort of position with your spotter, you will not win one of these races at Talladega or Daytona right now. And I think that goes back to my whole point of that skill level is definitely raised, but then it becomes such a heightened game to try and win one of these races. And it starts to lose, to me, it loses the mantra of anyone can win one.
Yeah, it really does become more of that team sport. And we heard Paul Wolf say that after the race, that the most important part of Keselowski's victory was execution, that nobody made a mistake.
Yep.
And Joey Meyer was included in that. Bud Denker, Penske executive, said Joey Meyer was the MVP of that race. Keselowski talked about how he was an all-star. And you're right, Parker. I mean, if you listen to that two radio chatter, he is telling him not just like where cars are, but which all three lines, which line has the most momentum, which line is stalling out. And it does seem like he uses that. Keselowski uses that to determine where he's going. And we've seen Dale Jr. talk about TJ Majors, his spotter, the same way, that he's able to communicate those things. You touched on a little bit, Keselowski and Dale Jr., I think, generally are considered two of the better plate racers right now. But I think going into any Talladega Daytona race, everybody's always looking at Dale Jr. But since 2009, since Brad Keselowski won his first Sprint Cup race at Talladega, he's won more plate races than anybody. He's won four plate races now with Sunday's win in the last 7 years. Does he get the credit he deserves, and what do you think makes him so good?
I don't know if he gets the credit he deserves in that sense. You know, he is a champion. I think, you know, at the end of the day, he's one of the best. We know he's one of the top drivers in the entire sport, and I think he definitely is able to, you know, find ways to be... It's put like it's basically to at times become a dominant force, and then no one's really talking about it, right? and I guess that's what he is at the Super Speedways. I'll tell you that from my time with him, and when I was going to Super Speedways, and we were doing a lot of time at that time with the tandem. And one of the things, Brad had so many terms and was so far ahead, I felt like, of the field and with Penske in terms of what we were developing when that tandem racing was happening. You know, we were, I felt like, at the forefront of terms like bumper pressure, which is where the pressure you're putting on from the front bumper of the car behind you to the rear bumper of the car in front of you. And everyone, when they watch that tandem thing, would think, oh, you know, okay, the back car is doing all the work. The front car is doing an incredible amount of work. And I felt like we were at the forefront of developing that in terms of beefing up the brakes on the front car, because the front car was solely responsible for keeping bumper pressure. So instead of the back car being the one that you think is, you know, nudging up against the front car, it's actually the front car is backing up to the rear, the back car, and actually forcing that back car to push it the whole time, using the brake, playing with the throttle, you know, moving where you need to be positioned in the corner. You needed to basically drive like an 18-wheeler, where you knew that car behind you was your trailer, and you wanted it to be in a certain position. And I felt like when we were going to this test out in Arizona, this big, you know, proving grounds and such, Brad was always very, very analytical of how we made that work, how we made speed out of the cars, how we made them last, how we made them, you know, cool down. And that's always the way he's been in all of his different types, you know, all racing. He's always been one of the more analytical racers out there. And I think because of that, it plays so well into super speedway racing. Super Speedway racing, it rewards homework, it rewards, you know, analysis, and it rewards basically being able to play a chess game, right? The mental chess game of Super Speedway racing. And I think he does that really, really well. At the end of the day, it plays a lot to his strengths in that sense. As well, as I said before, working with someone like Joey Meyer, we have a great relationship. They continually try to up their game. All those things combined, you know, adds up to him being one of the drivers that can get up there and hold the lead. And also, I think, put some credit for Penske Racing, Paul Wolf, who obviously, when their Super Speedway program wasn't great earlier this year, they were able to figure some things out and come back with a great Super Speedway program. So, all that adds up. Dale Jr., on the other hand, he is by far, bar none, one of the best side drafters, one of the best understanders. Right, that's not a great word, but one of the best at understanding the draft.
Right.
We did a piece on side drafting with the touch feed, and he was our main example because I think drivers have caught up, but for many years, you saw him do things coming through the tryout with Talladega. He'd dive from the top lane, get down to a car, use the side draft, put some air on their spoiler, and then shoot back up and use that to get a huge run to take the lead by himself. And people would be like, oh, he just has a faster car. I mean, yes, he has a fast car, but at the same time, it was just an incredible understanding of what was actually happening to the cars and to the air when you got side by side. And I think, you know, that's what made him so good. And I think he has a tremendous amount of confidence because of that, and it shows on the racetrack. Obviously, this year, they've got to figure out something with what they're doing to those race cars in terms of making speed, because he's had two races now this year where they basically spun out by themselves. So I think they'll kind of work on that and figure out, you know, okay, what are we doing that's creating speed but making this car so unstable in the draft?
Yeah.
Because it's unusual to me to see Dale Jr. not be very, very comfortable on super speedways and in super speedway cars. So I think that's something that they'll work on. But I saw him, he tweeted that they don't even know what they need to fix. So I think if you want to know why he's so good, it's just the basic understanding of air and the draft. Brad, it's his analytical nature that allows him to really study these races and put himself up front.
Right, right. That's a good comparison there, and certainly interesting. And you're right, Steve Wittard also on this podcast, and he talked about how Dale Jr. and Greg Ives are definitely going to need to figure out a different package for Daytona, because you can't have a guy who's that good in the draft just not able to keep the car under him because they're making the wrong choices on setup. And obviously he comes out of Talladega now, last place finish, needs some momentum going to a track where mile and a half track, this is the bread and butter of the Sprint Cup schedule. This is I think, going to, again, be a barometer of which teams are on their game in terms of looking forward toward the playoffs. And, Parker, we've got the low downforce package this year at Kansas Speedway making its debut. What are you expecting to see at Kansas with this new rules package? I know it had certainly an impact at Atlanta, at Las Vegas, in terms at Texas, in terms of the way passing changed. I would expect, are you expecting to see the same thing at Kansas?
Well, I wish it was a day race, first of all. I'm never a fan of these cold night races, I will tell you that. I think it negates a lot of the efforts that we put into creating great racing. But obviously it looks cool.
Hopefully Richmond will push that trend in the right direction, because that was such a huge success last weekend. Maybe I will get the drumbeat going for Sunday races, and I'm on board with you there completely.
I love it. I think we should definitely. I think night racing is a big detriment to the racing. It's just the high grip and such. You know, we know how to make the mechanical grip these days so well that when you add in all that mechanical grip into the racetrack, it's very tough to create something that's going to create good racing. But besides that fact, I will say this. I think that Kansas was the place I tried the low downforce package first time back in 2012 when I was doing a test in the 2013 Gen 6 car when everyone else was in the Gen 5. And we went out there, and immediately after 10 laps, I came in and I said, if you put this package on every car in the field right now, we would be, and this was right after it got repaved. And, you know, you think you're just going to be right on the bottom in the groove. And I said, we would be running from the wall to the apron. Because anywhere if I didn't need to turn the wheel, I was going to go faster. That's the best way to put it. It was so uncontrollably, just so uncontrollable at the time. Now, granted, we were on a hard tire that was being used for the Gen 5 car, which was going around there almost flat out at like 195 miles an hour. So that was pretty nuts. It gave me a great barometer thing, like, okay, this is something. I mean, and now going to Kansas, knowing it's had a little bit of wear on it and such, I think you're going to see a difference for sure. I think they'll have a high straightaway speed. I would hope that the groove does widen out, and I think it will. It really, as I said before, though, it just depends on the temperature and what we see grip level-wise out of the racetrack to see how much they'll move around. But I have to believe that this is going to be just another improvement from what we've seen at Kansas, especially since repave. And come day one, I think you'll see them right next to the wall. But this weekend, I think it will be an improvement. You'll see it move around. And I hope it's as cool as you've been seeing, because there's not been a time that this low downforce package has hurt anything. Let's make that very clear. It is absolutely, bar none, the right direction. Bar none, the best racing I've seen. And the best I've ever heard the drivers talk about a package and about driving the race cars.
Yeah.
So it's only going to be better. So if you have a mile and a half this year, just know it's going to be better than what it was. And that's the best way to put it.
Yeah. Yeah. No question. It's getting rave reviews. And in the driver council meeting this past weekend at Talladega, it sounds as if a lot of discussion about continuing to go in that direction, take even more downforce off, because again, it has been so well received. I think on all fronts, I think even from the fan front, if you look on social media, I think there's always going to be some detractors, but I think even they can see that when drivers are not trying to sell them something here, when they say that we're able to pass better, we're able to move around more. I certainly can see it when I'm at the races, and I hear people like you saying it as well. And obviously you've got an informed opinion, and that's also why we have you in the driver simulator every week on NASCAR America, showing us how this low downforce package reacts at the mile and a half track, such as Kansas. I'm sure we'll probably see you again in it this week. I wanted to ask you a little about that, Parker, because that's been a really cool element in the show. And you make it look easy, just like any driver gets in a car and makes it look easy. But not only are you driving in that simulator, you're also commentating. And now we've added the additional high wire act of putting you in live segments while driving in the live simulator. So tell us a little bit about how the evolution of the simulator as part of the show has happened, and how you've gotten so comfortable to be able to do all of it and do all these things at once.
Well, you brought the live part, and that's the fun part, because we've had a lot of jokes about that. But I'll tell you, it goes back to, I brought up iRacing once in this podcast already, so I might as well bring it twice. So back when I was coming up through the ranks, when I started go-karting, literally when I started go-karting, I started sim racing. I found both simultaneously. And so for years, my I had more experience in sim racing than I ever did in real racing. I'll give you an example. When I sat on the pole for the Xfinity race at Kansas in 09, and I'd won like 8 ARC races that season already, but I beat Kyle Busch for the pole that year. By that race, I'd only done like 40 car races my entire life.
Wow.
And Kyle Busch had done like 45 that year. So it was, or maybe more. I think he'd done like 60 that year. So, you know, but people would say, okay, well, where'd you get the experience? I'd say sim racing. I used to sim race hours upon hours every night. I'd get home from school, all throughout high school and everything, and, you know, first take a nap, then sim race all night, then go to school all day, take an energy drink or two, then go back, take a nap, go sim race all night. And it was just my routine. I sim raced constantly, and I, you know, raced all different types of race cars, road courses, ovals. I did everything. And that, doing so, when you were doing that, you always were on with buddies and talking and that sort of thing while you're racing. You'd almost come to your old races. So when we did the simulator deal, I was like, heck, I'm just sim racing again and talking to my buddies. So wow. that was a seamless transition. But the element of live that we've added in, if for me, I find it fine. It's no different for me because at the end of the day, you know, when we're recording them or we're doing it live, you know, you don't want to make a mistake. And I actually enjoy the live a little bit more because I think sometimes mistakes can add a little bit of comedy into it. But the interesting thing for us has been the producers and everyone asking all the time, okay, what happens if it just fails? What happens if you wreck? And it's like we would have to have this plan B to talk about for 3 minutes on air because, like, if the simulator fails, you're like, so that just broke, and we're going to just continue talking here. So, but no, it's been great. We've been doing a lot of cool stuff. And the funniest thing that I don't think a lot of people know is that, and we've been trying to point this out more and more, and we will, and we're going to bring it to light a couple times more this year, but is that everyone who does those similar segments with us is real. There are real people around the country, around the world, that come on and race against me basically in a practice session and do the show that we want to show. But, you know, to say that they could easily just spin out or make a mistake and suddenly the whole segment is ruined, especially when we're live, yes, that can happen. So if you're watching NASCAR America and we're doing live simulator, know that literally anything could happen, and it might be for some really good TV. So I stay tuned. We make a YouTube version of it. So
excellent. So every time that we're promoting your simulators on NBCSports.com/NASCAR, we should like tweet that out. Hey, live version of the simulator day you want to watch because this could be the most exciting moment of the show.
This could be a complete and utter disaster. And if it is, honestly, that would be a lot of fun. So we'll have a great time with it.
Okay,
so.
Great. How many laps would you say, or maybe how many hours would you say in your life you have spent behind the wheel of a racing simulator?
Oh, man. You know, there's a theory out there called the 10,000-hour theory. Right.
That is Malcolm Gladwell.
I guess it was from basketball that if you practice 10,000 hours of anything, you can become an expert at it. Right. You would negate the ability for need for talent. And I would say, I mean, I have to do the math, but I mean, if you want to add up 6 to 8 hours every night, probably 350 days a year. So just do the math on that. That might be 350 hours a year, almost. Wow.
More than 1,000 then, obviously. We're in the thousands in terms of hours. Okay. That explains
exactly.
It.
So, I'm sorry. Yeah, no, it'd be like 3,000. So, I mean, definitely in the thousands.
That explains why you're so comfortable on live television. I mean, it's hard enough for me to like walk and chew gum at the same time, much less talk on live television in a somewhat cogent manner. So now I sort of get a little bit more of an understanding.
Job.
No, not about that. No, you do a great job when you're actually like wheeling it and explain to people how side drafting works all while live in front of, you know, God knows how many people watching on TV.
You just remind me, it's a funny story, real quick, before we go on. But the most recent one at Talladega, and since we've been doing these Super Speedway ones, we want to, like, put a big pack up there. So we'll get 30, almost, you know, almost a full field sometimes of cars. And then they put me in the pack. Well, one thing you need to know is that normally in iRacing, you have a computer spotter, which anytime a car is in your, you know, it seals it in your zone. It's just like a real life spot. It'll say inside, outside, three wide, that sort of thing. When I do the stimulus thing, I don't have a spotter. So our producers become my spotter. So they're trying to tell me, basically, we have 2 minutes left. Hey, toss it to DJ to talk about this, blah, blah. And the same time trying to spot for me, because at times I'll be three wide and I can't tell you where the cars are, and I can't clear myself because I've got the real mirror, and I maybe just lost where the other car is. So it's a massive ballet balancing act that we conduct every time we do it. So I'm telling you, if when they're live, you got to tune in, because we're bound to run out of luck at some time and have quite a funny turn.
This is great. So what you're telling me is Ricky Diamond and Sean Owens are the Joey Meyer and TJ Majors of driving simulators, basically. Okay.
Exactly.
I love it. Okay, for people who don't know, those are producers from NASCAR America, so I just want to give them a little plug because they're obviously a part of this as well.
Oh, and John Barnes.
And John Barnes. Well, we can say, I put him as maybe the Brett Griffin of NASCAR America simulating spotting.
Yeah.
All right, well, you can watch him behind the simulator on NASCAR America. You can watch him behind the wheel of a real race car or truck this weekend at Kansas Speedway, and certainly appreciate him joining the podcast as always. Parker, good luck this weekend, and thanks for being on.
Thank you, Nate. Appreciate it. Look forward to getting to the racetrack, and everyone tune in and following us in this 92 truck. It'll be a lot of fun these next couple weeks.
Our thanks to Parker Kligerman and Steve Wittart for joining us on the NASCAR on NBC podcast. Thanks as well to Tess Quinlan for producing. Tess made sure that you can listen to the podcast on Stitcher. You also can find it on SoundCloud or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes for automatic downloads of new episodes. We'll be back with another episode of the podcast next week. Our guest will be Kyle Petty, in part discussing his annual motorcycle charity ride, which is ongoing as we speak. Hope you enjoyed this episode. Thanks again for listening.